Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. If I follow the media, I'm supposed to be talking about President Trump's tweets against the four socialist congresswomen, telling them to go back and fix the countries from whence they came. That's what everyone's talking about this week, but that's not the subject for my program. But if I were to do a program on that event, it would be about the Machiavellian political hypocrisy of the whole thing. Matthew 23, Romans chapter 2, in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge, practice the same thing. Donald Trump is no more obnoxious, uncivil, uncouth, racist, xenophobic than these four leftist congresswomen. They just can't stand it when what they say about others is being said about them. I think the public is catching on to this whole use of the racist label as a way of not dealing with issues. And I wonder if soon calling someone a racist is going to be passé, archaic, behind the times. Well, enough of that. The topic for this week's program is reparations. The recent movement to have the federal government financially compensate the black community for slavery and discriminatory laws and practices in America's past. I've never done a program on this topic, mainly because there have been so many more relevant topics to discuss, and the possibility of reparations has never been taken serious. Even President Barack Obama said about reparations, quote, "It's easy to make that theoretical argument, but as a practical matter, it's hard to think of any society in human history in which a majority of the population has said that as a consequence of historic wrongs, we are now going to take a big chunk of the nation's resources over a long period of time to make it right." But in June, Congress finally held hearings to discuss the possibility of reparation. John Conyers, the African-American congressman from the Detroit area, has been putting forth a bill every year from 1989 to 2017, asking Congress to hold hearings on reparations. Conyers had to step down in 2017 due to sexual harassment allegations. Sheila Jackson, congresswoman from Texas, took up the bill, and it finally passed the House, and so hearings were held last month. We're going into the presidential election season, so we're not going to be hearing much more about reparations. Reparations are not popular with the American public. A recent Rasmussen poll said 80% of the public is opposed to reparations. The government's practically bankrupt. It borrows 25% on every dollar it spends, and there's no way to figure out who's going to get those reparations and who's going to pay for them. These hearings, like many congressional hearings, were not meant to pass any legislation, but to pacify certain special interest groups in the party base so politicians can go back to their constituents and say, hey, we tried, we cared, we're the party of reparations, even though they know full well that they'd rather not deal with the issue. All of the Democratic candidates say they're supportive of reparations. No one dares to be against reparations and be singled out as being anti-black. Elizabeth Warren even suggested that there should be reparations for the LGBT community. But it's just one of those things that you can support for political showmanship without having to act on. Just this last week, New York Senator Chuck Schumer came out in favor of reparations in an article in Axios. Senator Minority Leader Chuck Schumer told a small group of reporters Tuesday that he will support legislation proposed by Republican Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas and Senator Cory Booker in New Jersey to establish a commission to study reparations for slavery. Why it matters? As the top Democrat in the Senate, Schumer's support strengthens not only the legislation's future, but also benefits a continual conversation on the reparation issue. So this is the next step. First was the hearings. Now they want a commission. Now, Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader of the Republican Party, said the following about reparations. I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea. We've tried to deal with our original sins of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country. No one currently alive was responsible for that. And I don't think we should be trying to figure out how to compensate for it. First of all, it would be pretty hard to figure out who to compensate. No, I don't think reparations are a good idea. And of course, the political left went ballistic, criticizing McConnell as being a white supremacist, as belittling the issue. And the opposition dug up the fact that his great-great-grandfather apparently owned 14 slaves. McConnell later responded to that story by saying he and President Obama have something in common. Quote, "I find myself once again in the same position as President Obama. We both oppose reparations and we both are descendants of slave owners." So does this mean the Obama family has to pay reparations, but only half the amount because he's only half black? But then the reparations he would receive would only be half the amount, so it would kind of be a wash. But then again, the black side of his family wasn't here in America for slavery. His father was a government economist from Kenya who came over in the 60s. So then the Obama family should receive nothing and yet only pay half the amount of reparations. So you see that we have a problem with reparations already. So that's the issue. But what does the Bible have to say about it? For me, the whole issue is just another good opportunity to show us how to determine and judge public policy by the standards of the Word of God, rather than our emotions, rather than by our wants. Everyone can have an opinion or preference, but what does the Word of God say? Sure, everybody would like to receive a check in the mail. Everyone would like to be compensated for economic disadvantages against one's ancestors, but is it right? There were abuses and the shunning of Irish and Italian immigrants who came to the United States. There were abuses against Chinese immigrants. Even early Jewish immigrants weren't allowed in certain institutions and offices. President Roosevelt turned away a whole ship full of Jews fleeing from the Nazi Holocaust. Japanese Americans were put in internment camps. Then there were the American Indians, many of whom were glad for and helped by English civilization, but some didn't assimilate so well. And many white settlers in America were indentured servants. You'd be very hard-pressed to find someone in America who has not been economically disadvantaged by the sins of their ancestors at some point. This is just the nature of the fallen world. And this whole subject of reparations touches on the subject of original sin, how the actions of others affect us for good or for evil. And worse than any government policy or any discriminatory law, if your father was an alcoholic, if your father was immoral or lazy, or even if your father or your grandfather was a typical unsaved man who lives in the lust of his flesh, indulging in the desires of the flesh and of the mind, as it says in Ephesians chapter 2, that is probably, in most cases, a far worse disadvantage than anything a government or a neighbor could do to you. What is the real measure of disadvantage? Does it come from our past? Does it come from government policy? From lack of money? Or are our disadvantages more a function of our personal moral choices? And let me suggest that our own personal moral choices, 90% of our disadvantages come from that. And if we live a righteous life, whatever disadvantages we have inherited from the past are easily overcome. The biblical Christian emphasis is that people become successful by the blessing of the Lord, by the fruit of a righteous life. And we overcome evil with good. And we overcome the past by personal, excellent moral behavior in the present. The biblical book of 1 Peter is all about dealing with persecutions and disadvantages. 1 Peter 2:15, "For such is the will of God that by doing right you might silence the ignorance of foolish men." 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 13, "Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidations. Do not be troubled." And 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 16, "And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame." That's the Christian worldview. And we are to let the blessings of righteousness be our help and be our compensation. Whenever an individual or a people group try to advance themselves by retribution, it doesn't go well for them. So it's really out of love and wanting the best for the African American community that we urge them to emphasize personal righteousness over retribution. Let God take care of the retribution. James chapter 2, "So speak and so act as those who are judged by the law of liberty." But let's first consider what the Bible has to say about servanthood and financial compensation. Deuteronomy chapter 15 is often quoted in this regard. Verse 12, "If your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free." Servanthood was limited to a maximum of 6 years. "When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flocks and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give him as the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this day." After the Civil War, the plan for Reconstruction was to give every former slave 40 acres and a mule. But Lincoln was shot. The abolitionists were outvoted, so it never came to pass, which was one of America's national travesties. Those reparations would have been easy to do at that time. There's plenty of land. It would have cost the government practically nothing. In fact, according to biblical law, every family should receive 40 acres because the land was never supposed to be monopolized by a few. It was to be divided up equally among the people so there wouldn't be an owner class, the landlords, and a peasant class, the renters. And following that biblical principle would solve most of the poverty problems in America today. But don't hold your breath waiting for it. So I believe the Christian community would be all in on some sort of permanent land and housing redistribution for the poor, not just the black community, but all those who have been dispossessed from the land. But historically, these former slaves not only did not receive land, they were taken advantage of by corrupt developers, landlords, redlining, the denial of FHA loans. Ta-Nehisi Coates, a black activist, wrote an essay in 2014 entitled "The Case for Reparations." It was published in The Atlantic. You should be aware of this piece. You should read if you get a chance because it's considered the article that got this whole movement for reparations revitalized. And in that piece, Coates relates story after story of how prejudice put African Americans at an economic disadvantage. He has a lengthy section about corruption in Chicago housing. And it's really outrageous how evil and greedy some people were toward the black community. But the truth is, this wasn't really about white people persecuting blacks. That's the wrong classification. This was about a bunch of ungodly, mafia-like, 19th century immigrants from Europe who had no Christian ethics when it came to making a buck, cheating the black community. It wasn't the white Protestant base, the group that was fighting for abolition and human rights. They did not do this to the black community. And in this, we need to consider that the activists and the politicians in our day, in their spiritual ignorance, have made an error in classification. Prejudice bias has never been a white-black thing as much as it's been an ungodly versus godly thing. That's a category that has made all the difference in behavior and outcomes. If we can figure out a way to make the ungodly pay for their past behavior, then maybe there would be justice. But to classify people merely on the basis of the color of their skin and make that the basis for penalty is the epitome of injustice. 360,000 Northern troops died in the Civil War fighting the evils of slavery. These were white families who lost fathers. In the day before welfare and Social Security, after the Civil War, many of these fatherless children made up the new poor white. So how shall we compensate these families, these soldiers? And in 1865, the United States was really a union of 34 different small countries, states. So should every state pay for reparations? Maybe just the slave states. And should not, for the sake of justice, the families who did not own slaves and who fought in the Civil War against the states that allowed for slavery, should they not be exempt from paying reparations? It would be an evil historic precedent if a people group were required to pay for that which they did not do. So that in 100 years, maybe a movement would start to make reparations to the people who are wrongly forced to make reparations. But I digress. Coates begins the piece, the case for reparations, by quoting Deuteronomy 15:12. Coates is an atheist, so his claim to biblical precedent is unusual. But nevertheless, the point of Deuteronomy 15 is that the owner of the slave was to compensate the slave for his service. It is not implying that the master was doing anything wrong in having an indentured servant. The indentured servant might have become a servant to pay off his debts or because of a crime, but when it was time for his release, the master needed to provide for him. Now, in that text, Deuteronomy 15, the Israelites were reminded that they were once slaves, and this harkens back to when the Israelites left Egypt after being enslaved by the Egyptians. Exodus 12:35, the Jews asked the Egyptians for their gold. And the Egyptians were more than happy to give them their gold to get them out of their nation. But the bottom line is that the principle in Deuteronomy 15 is that the master was to compensate the slave or the servant by setting him up to make it on his own. And that law must be united with another law found in Deuteronomy 24:16. The law against group responsibility or guilt. Deuteronomy 24:16, fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. Now, this principle is not limited to the death penalty. The context of that principle is in regard to any compensation, even towards servants. Deuteronomy 24:14, you shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land, in your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and he sets his heart on it, so that he will not cry against you to the Lord, and it becomes a sin to you. So it was a sin for the employer to withhold wages because he is personally responsible. However, notice the next principle. Verse 16, fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. You shall not pervert the justice due an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge. The point is that personal guilt is not group guilt. Wages, criminal punishment are to be paid by the one committing the crime or by the one hiring the servant. There's an example of this principle in regard to the compensation of the Gibeonites. Remember when the Israelites came into the land of Israel, the Gibeonites tricked the Israelis into making a treaty with them. So the Gibeonites were the one tribe of the Canaanites that were not annihilated. That's Joshua chapter 9. However, in the reign of King Saul, Saul broke that contract. And he slaughtered some of the Gibeonites and he took their land. So in the reign of David, God sent a famine on the whole land of Israel. David asked why, and God says that it was because of the sin against the Gibeonites. This was God's vengeance and recompense on the entire nation of Israel. 2 Samuel 21. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. So the king, King David, called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, what should I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And the Gibeonites said to him, we have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. And he said, I will do for you whatever you say. So they said to the king, the man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the borders of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. Now, someone might look at this text and say, aha, you see, the whole nation is punished for the king's crime against the Gibeonites years ago. National compensation, therefore, must be made. But when it comes to punishing a whole nation for the crimes of an administration or the crimes of one man, that is something only God is allowed to do. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Man doesn't have the authority or the wisdom to punish an entire people group for the sins of a few. The requirement for human public policy is Deuteronomy 24:16, fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sins. Now, notice in that event, in the reign of David, the Gibeonites say, we don't want silver or gold. Nor would it be right for just any man in Israel to pay the price for King Saul's crimes against us. That would be injustice on man's part to punish everyone in Israel for the crimes of Saul and his administration. And in this, the Gibeonite leaders were correct. So instead, they asked for 7 sons of Saul to be put to death, the remaining 7 members of Saul's household. Now, at first, this seems like a violation of Deuteronomy 24:16. The sons are being put to death for the sins of the father. But in ancient times, the king's entire family was the administration. These sons likely had authority in the days of Saul, and they likely conspired with their father to murder the Gibeonites. This principle is seen in the Nuremberg trials. Those who had a hand in the Jewish Holocaust in Germany were tried and punished. Even today, those guilty are still being found. In 2017, Reinhold Hanning, 95 years old, was convicted of his crimes as an SS officer. And in 2018, President Trump deported a 95-year-old man from Queens, a former German prison guard. He was deported back to Germany for trial. The Christian community should be all in on requiring compensation from slave owners or from anyone who violated the civil rights of others. And if guilt is to be laid at anyone's feet, it needs to be laid at the feet of the king, the legislators, the people in the administration that perpetrated the injustice. So let's do that. Let's round up all the legislators who passed Jim Crow laws. Let's round up all the legislators and judges who supported abortion. Let's hope that someday there will be Nuremberg-like trials here in the United States against all who legislated for the murder of 150 million infants. That crime dwarfs America's slavery issue. If these activists want to enact biblical moral justice, they might be the first ones prosecuted for their crimes against humanity. And I kind of believe this is one of the reasons why talk of reparations is not very popular. Because those on the left know in the recesses of their conscience that this opens up a whole can of ethical issues that they would rather not deal with. They know that this will come back on their own heads. So, by way of conclusion, let me list a few points to consider here. Number one, the opposition to reparations, the anger that Americans feel toward even the discussion of reparations, is because of an ingrained American value that it's wrong to make someone else pay for something they didn't do. We all remember back in elementary school, that teacher who would make the whole class stay after because of the misbehavior of a few bad students. And I remember that as a young person, and it always irked me. I suppose the teacher thought that this would be a way to put social pressure on the bad students to behave better, but what the teacher was doing was unjust. You know, it's the same reason why people hate racial profiling. An entire group is being persecuted for the bad behavior of someone who has their same skin color. You can't be against racial profiling and be for blanket reparations. Number two, how is the black community to be compensated? A very large percentage of African Americans came to America after slavery, even after the Jim Crow laws. Number three, how is it fair to compensate one minority when others have also been adversely affected by various forms of discrimination and economic disadvantages? Number four, are not the programs to help all the poor a better way to deal with any disadvantages we have inherited from the past? We already have some great compensation for poor people in America. A college education is just about free for anybody who's poor. And if you make anywhere near the poverty level, you do not pay a dime in federal income tax. And that is really huge. In ancient Israel, that was a privilege given only to a special few people. To be free from being taxed, as in 1 Samuel 17:25, the man who kills Goliath, his house will be free in Israel. So America takes care of her poor. Her disadvantaged people, they are given special advantages. So let's be careful of any policy to beware that it doesn't come from a heart of ingratitude, a focus on what we don't have rather than on the opportunities we do have. Because there is no satisfying envy and greed. Number five, is not one of the reparations the privilege of living in the wealthiest country on earth? 6 billion people on earth would give their right arm for the privilege of living here in America, even the privilege of working in an Amazon warehouse making $15 an hour. Number six, was not the price of the Civil War the bloodiest conflict in American history, a war that cost more lives than all of America's wars combined? Was not this part of the cost of slavery paid for by Americans? In Lincoln's second inaugural address, Lincoln explained to his critics how long the Civil War would be. Quote, "Yet if God wills that it continues until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of uncompensated toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash or the whip shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as it was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." The blood was spilled and paid for. The abolitionists were willing to pay the ultimate price to free other men from slavery, their own lives. And a seventh point that flows from this is that in many matters, compensatory judgment needs to be left to God. For example, in the Islamic world, there's this principle of continual retribution against those who have done you wrong. And so, without a theology of forgiveness, and without a theology of vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord, everyone is out for an endless payback. And in those societies, they are always at war with themselves. Because Christians believe in forgiveness, because we believe that God is the one who settles the score, because we believe in the great white throne judgment, Christian societies are not embroiled in the same endless revenge. Instead, there can be peace. If you get a chance, check out this article in World Magazine by Scott Allen, A Tale of Two Worldviews, subtitle, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the fellow who wrote the article in The Atlantic, A Case for Reparation, is tearing down what Martin Luther King Jr. built up. And the gist of the article is the theological worldview differences between Coates and Martin Luther King. And these theological differences are behind their different policy proposals. Martin Luther King maintained the biblical view of human nature. Human nature transcends ethnicity. All of us are made in God's image, and all of us are sinners. Coates' view of human identity is radically different. He absolutizes, if that's a word, absolutize. He absolutizes the forces of culture and community. Author Nancy Percy describes this postmodern anthropology. Individuals are little more than mouthpieces for communities based on race, class, gender, ethnicity, and sexual identity. For Coates, there is no common human nature that binds us together. Rather, our identity is determined entirely by ethnicity. Given this, there is little room for individuality, volition, or personal responsibility. In short, for Coates, the individual means very little. The group defines everything. In one of his most controversial statements, Coates describes to his son his reaction to watching the New York City police and firefighters rush into the World Trade Center building on 9/11. Quote from Coates, "They were not human to me, black, white, or whatever. They were menaces of nature. They were fire, the comet, the storm." Here you see not only Coates' disdain for the police and the firefighters who sacrificed their lives on 9/11, but also his inability to see people as individuals, as fellow human beings. His worldview, atheistic, reduces them to subhuman representatives of oppressive groups. So it's no surprise that given his faulty worldview, Coates is emphasizing the need for reparations. Scott Allen goes on to explain other theological errors in regard to ultimate reality, human nature, the source of evil, justice, America, violence, civil rights. And so what is at the heart of this movement is bad theology. That's why they are emphasizing the need for reparations rather than other biblical practical responses. But that all gets very deep. For typical conversation about this subject, the bottom line is that biblically, reparations are unjust. It's unjust to require reparations from those who had no part in the crime. There is no justice in requiring corporate guilt. In the congressional hearings on reparations, a black man by the name of Coleman Hughes gave testimony, and he made the point that people who were owed for slavery are no longer here and were not entitled to collect on their debts. Quote, "Nothing I'm about to say is meant to minimize the horror and the brutality of slavery and Jim Crow. Racism is a bloody stain on this country's history. And I consider our failure to pay reparations directly to freed slaves after the Civil War to be one of the greatest injustices ever perpetrated by the U.S. government. But I worry that our desire to fix the past compromises our ability to fix the present. Think about what we're doing today. We're spending our time debating a bill that mentions slavery 25 times, but incarceration only once. In an era with zero black slaves, but nearly a million black prisoners, a bill that doesn't mention homicide once, at a time when the Center for Disease Control reports homicide as the number one cause of death for young black men, I'm not saying that acknowledging history doesn't matter. It does. I'm saying there is a difference between acknowledging history and allowing history to distract us from the problems we're facing today. If we were to pay reparations today, we would only divide the country further, making it harder to build the political coalitions required to solve the problems facing black people today. We would insult many black Americans by putting a price on the suffering of their ancestors, and we would turn the relationship between black Americans and white Americans from a coalition into a transaction, from a union between citizens into a lawsuit between plaintiffs and defendants. What we should do is pay reparations to black Americans who actually grew up under Jim Crow and were directly harmed by second-class citizenship, people like my grandparents. But paying reparations to all descendants of slaves is a mistake. Take me, for example. I was born three decades after Jim Crow ended into a privileged household in the suburbs. I attended an Ivy League school, yet I'm also descendant from slaves who worked on Thomas Jefferson's plantation. So reparations for slavery would allocate federal resources to me, but not to an American with the wrong ancestry. Even if that person is living paycheck to paycheck and working multiple jobs to support a family, you might call that justice. I call it justice for the dead at the price of justice for the living. I understand that reparations are about what people are owed, regardless of how well they're doing. But the people who are owed for slavery are no longer here, and we're not entitled to collect on their debts. Reparations, by definition, are only given to victims. So the moment you give me reparations, you've made me into a victim without my consent. Not just that, you've made one-third of Black America, who consistently poll against reparations, into victims without their consent. And Black Americans have fought too long for the right to define themselves to be spoken for in such condescending manner. The question is not what America owes me by virtue of my ancestry. The question is what all Americans owe each other by virtue of being citizens of the same nation. And the obligations of citizenship is not transactional. It is not contingent on ancestry. It never expires. It can't be paid off. For all of these reasons, Bill H.R. 40 is a moral and political mistake. Thank you. Well said, Mr. Hughes. But expect the world to now hate you. As Jesus said, the world hates me because I testify of it, that its deeds are evil. John chapter 7, verse 7. Expect the same if you also live by and testify to the truth. So thank you for taking the time to make God and Country a part of your discipleship in the Word. The website is godandcountryradio.org. We finally put up the new website. It still needs some aesthetic improvement, but it's functional. So check it out. By request, I'm also including in the YouTube link on the website the option of YouTube audio only. This way, if you're driving in the car and you want to listen to the YouTube, you don't have to use up all of your monthly bandwidth. I don't have time to go back and create the audio for all the first 72 YouTubes, but from here on out, I hope that option will be available. And if you have not subscribed to the channel, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. This adds the channel to your watch list, and it helps the cause. So keep the faith, stand firm. May the blessings of God abound in your life as you continue to live by the Word of God.